Hi, Keith and the Girls, Keith Malley here.
I'm Khamda.
Welcome to My Opening Line. You know what it's about. We talk to artists, comedians. How did they get started? What is their villain origin story? That's what this show is about. First, let me mention this. Download the Laughable app. Go to laughable.com. You download the app. Subscribe to podcasts through that. But I already subscribed to... What am I doing? Wasting your time? There's obviously more. Subscribe to the person.
My favorite part of that is that a lot of people have podcasts now, right?
Yeah.
So you can follow them on their podcasts. But some people are great podcast guests and they'll never host a podcast themselves, but you can follow them guesting on other people's shows.
Let's say you take a comedian, Shane Moss, okay? You type in Shane Moss, you hit subscribe. When he's on a show, any show, even if you never heard of it, that show will automatically pop into your feed. He goes, you know what? I'm my friend. He's a little jerk off, but I'll do him a favor. I'll do his little show. I'll tell a secret or two. Nobody's listening. Surprise, idiot. We're all fucking listening. Ladies and gentlemen, today's guest has been on Jimmy Kimmel, Showtime, Comedy Central Presents, Shane Moss.
Did you just call me an idiot in that story?
I'm just kidding. You have to wait until your mic's on and then
right,
it's a different
segment.
Right,
and then segment. And I'm in the thing.
Right, now you're here. Ta-da! Hi!
Hi!
Shane is so very, very funny, and I definitely want to know how the whole game started with him. I've noticed I ask this question a lot, and it's a big one to me, I think. What got you into stand-up? The love of good people, of amazing people, or people being bad at it? I got into podcasting because the three podcasts that were out there were unlistenable. Mm-hmm. And I said, there's no way this movement starts with this.
I had a little bit of that early on in my career. I have a strange one because I decided I was going to be a stand-up comedian before I'd ever seen stand-up comedy. I was like 9 years old. I was playing the game Punisher on Nintendo.
Okay.
And I made some joke. I don't remember what the joke was.
Like, why would my parents let me have a game called Punisher? They must not care about me. Like a joke like that?
And it really got him going. And he was like, you should be a stand-up comedian. And I was like, what's that? And he's like, oh,
it's like a clown for adults.
It's someone that stands on a stage and like makes people laugh and tells jokes. And I was like... Yeah, that's like, I didn't tell anyone that, but I was like, it just got in my head because it was like that age when everyone's like, are you going to be a surgeon or a firefighter? Right. You know, and like nothing seemed appealing. My parents, it seemed like their jobs drove them crazy. Right. From my perception, everyone's job is just this horrible thing.
Who was telling this to you? Somebody online in the game?
This is before the online gaming. Okay. This is a neighbor kid that I was playing.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. And, wow. And I would say we were about 9 years old, maybe younger than that. And yeah. And then
start looking for stand-ups?
Yeah. I think like kind of Cheech and Chong was maybe some of the first stuff that I saw. And I was like, that doesn't really make sense to me.
So much about you.
But it does now. Yeah. It must've got in there. I remember early on, liking Emo Phillips and Stephen Wright.
Very quirky people, right?
Yeah. And early on in my career, I was very much quirky like that, yeah. Like an absurdist. My act has changed quite a bit since then. But I think I remember I remember really liking this Dana Carvey special when he's like playing fake drums or something like that. And Mr. Bean, Jim Carrey was like my favorite person ever. Actually, I love Jim Carrey. I love the new show, Kidding. That was my early and whatever, you know, it was just the fertile garden of childhood imagination. It got in there early enough. Cause if it would have been a little later, like I still kind of believed in myself.
I already have a firefighter mission.
Yeah. It was also like I by the time like fifth grade rolled around, I had no self-esteem whatsoever. And I didn't think that so it got in there like when I still thought I could do stuff. Yeah. And it got in, it was just like, it was perfect timing because I just didn't agree with my upbringing and like religion and stuff. I was like very confused about it. And it was the one thing that I was like, oh, that makes sense to me.
Do you do skits or stand up to your family, to friends that come over? Would you do little things? I would walk around with a tape recorder and put on a show. This, I don't know how my parents could afford it, this $100 silver Radio Shack. And I put on shows. And I'd interview my brother about the pissing in the school radiator. Would you do anything like that?
No, I didn't tell anybody. I didn't tell anyone that I my parents were very practical people. And I thought, like, if I tell them what my dream is, they're just going to, like, poo-poo it and tell me I can't do that. And I have to do accounting or whatever. And so, yeah, I never told anyone. I remember, like, doing, like, Tim Allen impressions or whatever. Okay. My dad was into Tool Time or Home Improvement. Was that the show?
Yeah, I did those impressions, too. I just didn't mean to. Anytime somebody told me something, I misunderstood it and did something different. In that way, I was Tim the Tool Man.
That was my early. I told people that I was from back home because I moved to Boston from Wisconsin because I didn't want anyone I knew being any. I could have gone to an open mic in my town and no one I knew would have ever, you know, but I was so paranoid about it. I didn't even want to go to like 2 hours away to Madison or Minneapolis. So I was like, what if someone from high school sees me? I went to Boston. So no one that I knew that I was a stand-up comedian until the week before I was going to be on Conan. I let people know that I was going to be on TV the following week. Yeah.
At what age do you do a regular club?
I was 23 when I moved to Boston. My 23rd birthday, I was like, I haven't pursued anything that I told myself I was going to, blah, blah, blah. I'm miserable in this factory job. Gosh darn it, I'm going to do it. And I had a friend going to Boston. And then it took me a few months. And I went and I did the comedy studio in Boston. Rick Jenkins, who the owner.
Is this your first time on stage?
Yeah, I had. I went through. I was like, how do you be a comedian? Like, I didn't. I could have just Googled, how do you become a stand-up comedian? And instead, what I did was I opened the Yellow Pages and looked up comedy clubs, and I just started calling comedy clubs, and I was like, I'd like to be a comedian. Like, how does that work? Like, how can I go and be a comedian?
That's so funny, because even if I know that there are phone numbers to comedy clubs, but they're intended to make, like, reservations or ask questions, so the person picking up has nothing to do with anything, so it's extra funny.
I happened to, Rick Jenkins was like a very small business, and he did everything himself and like curates young comics and everything for these shows. And he happened to live like a couple blocks away, and where I lived was on his walk. Like, he walked past my apartment building on the way to the club. And I was able to get him on the phone, and he dropped off a packet of like information and like a couple tickets to like check out a show and stuff. And I like read all this stuff, and then I was, and then
did
I
did you learn
like,
anything to, from the packet?
I don't remember the packets. Mm-hmm. I know it was like dense, full of like information that was probably just like pain in the ass, regular stupid.
What could
rookie
it,
questions.
What could it be?
Wash comedy. Your hands after you pee.
These words are funny.
It wasn't anything like that. I know it was probably like a list of open mics around town.
Do you want
like,
to be using like Binox?
Stick to your time.
Stick to your time.
A list of funny. Also, K sounds are really funny.
If you're going to say binocular, say kaleidoscope. Right? Things like that. But all of them. Just, I mean, you're saying packets.
He's just dropping packets. He's written a book and is just waiting for young aspiring comics to call up so he can drop off this bizarre manifesto.
Dude, I got a new list. We thought like cues, you know, if you get lucky, but there's a lot.
Have you tried on the stool? Well, you sit down on the stool, you look comfortable, but if you put your knees up, you look real wacky for a second. Try that out.
Now, that doesn't mean stick with cues. But if you could say quiet, say shush, right? Not go somewhere a little different.
Are these tricks that you use?
Yeah. 13 and a half years.
Oh my God.
You say tricks, I say illusions.
No, tricks is better. Don't you think tricks is funny?
Yeah, which one?
Well,
took
well check the manifesto. It can mean many things. See? Tricks can mean now different you're gonna, things. Now you're on put. Now you're in pun town.
Now you're going to go on the forums and debate that.
The boom. Forums. There yeah. was a forum. Oh, I was so active early on, too. I was like a real comedy police situation. Yeah. Like, you got to be original. What is this 4-hour Viagra stuff? I mean, I was right, but like the level of intensity I had right. Early on, and I was very passionate. I yearn for that old passion sometimes. Boy, right. what I wouldn't give to just like have like a week of that early passion.
What is funny when you see veteran comedians, and of course you ask what's the secret to stand up, and they'll say get on stage as much as you can, but to them it's like there's nothing else they could do,
right?
And they're just fucking around, though, like not even to for the, it's funny when I this is in my head because this just happened the other day where I happened to show up at a comedy club, a small club.
No, that's a great, if it happened like a year ago, make it seem more recent.
Right.
Say the other day. Yeah. Oh, it sounds like it's just coming off the top of your head.
Right. You got to be careful. It's funny when the comedians go on stage and they don't know how they're going to start. And they're like, how you guys doing? I'm feeling good. Shit. I'm not feeling good. I was just in a car accident. Right. But anyway, I was in this comedy club and the person's on stage. So they're famous enough and they're not giving a shit. And then they see me after and they're like, oh, don't go by that weird room. And it's like, no, you didn't give a shit because thought 10 tourists were watching you and who cares? So yeah, you know what I mean? Like, remember the passion.
Give
a fuck.
I know.
So at what age do you realize that comedians did write things down and not just show up?
Oh, so when I was, you know, as soon as my parents had cable or anytime I saw stand up on late night or anything like that, like when Comedy Central came out, that was like I obsessively just watched every bit of I saw every single stand up anything that ever has existed on Comedy Central from the time of its origin up until 2009 is when I stopped. But I obsess many times often. Cool. And I gained a real sense, you know, that was kind of my education.
Right. They go from show to show. It's the same story.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, maybe one word changes to a K sound.
Yeah. So I started when I was like 15, I started like taking little notes to myself, like terrified anyone would ever catch me taking a note.
I used to be upset. I didn't know that comedians necessarily wrote things down. When you went on Letterman, when a comic goes on Letterman and then they go on Leno and it's the same story, and I'm like, no, you don't have two fucking stories?
Yeah, I don't think I ever had that. It, you know what's strange to me is audiences, you'll be like, you'll say something. Like, I have a story about going to see Duck Dynasty, the musical.
Okay.
What
the? Now, okay. It's a real thing that existed for a very short amount of time. And I get that it sounds unreal. And that's part of the fun of the story. But it's a very long story. And it's very specific. And people are always like, was that really a thing afterwards? I'm like, well, you thought that was all just my imagination. But then I'll be like, so I saw like a flying octopus the other day or something in a joke. And people are like, whoa, so that's crazy that you saw a flying octopus. Do people just have no sense of like what is imagination and what isn't?
You're ready to quit every night, even though good for you, you tricked them. You illusioned them. Trick might be better. You're right.
Did you find an open mic to go up on?
So the first process was like I had to read the packet and then go and check out some shows so I could see what it's like. And it's a showcase show. And there were some new people and there were some really funny people and there were some bad people as well. It's like Yeah, it was a showcase show.
Right.
And
would you give advice at 23? Like, stick with it.
No. I was such a shy kid. If you ask any of my relatives, or like, no one can believe I became a stand-up, because I never talked. Like, in my entire upbringing, I just never talked. I was very shy. I still, my face is prone to getting beet red at any given moment, as a 38-year-old man. And so I was I was terrified, and I was just well, this was your life plan, you don't have an education, and I was just oh, God, I guess I have to. And it just, the closer it got to reality, and it's part of why I put it off, because I was I'm going to escape from high school. I'm going to move to New York City. I'm going to be a famous stand-up comedian. And then just the reality of getting on stage and the stage fright, hit me. And I remember finally watching enough shows and putting together material and being okay, I think I'm ready. And I remember Rick being on the phone. I remember I was on my lunch break and God, I got to get out of this. I just got to call and I got to do this. I got to book this spot. I need out of this work. And thinking that you get on stage a few times and now you no longer have to do construction work.
Right.
and that is the funniest joke on myself. Right.
What'd you do in construction?
Well, I did. So my father owns a countertop business.
Okay.
And so I had experience doing that, but I did a lot of factory work because I didn't like working with my dad when I was an angsty teenager. And so I had a lot of factory and a lot of construction construction experience and some countertop background that I was able to oversell myself. I actually didn't know how to make countertops, but I was able to be my dad owns a countertop business. They're well, you're hired. How often does the perfect person come around? And then I was awful at it and got laid off. And
does the comedy club owner say, all right, we're ready for you to perform. How many friends do you have?
I don't think that happened with him. Every other club in town was sure, you just got to bring 10 friends. And I was I just moved here. I don't have 10 friends. And if I did, I wouldn't want them to see my first time. I didn't think I was going to go on stage and it was going to be awesome. I thought this is going to be really hard and I'm going to have to work, pretty hard at this. But also that should take a month or so. And,
How much training does one need?
But still nobody thinks that way. Right. So worst case scenario, you leave and you're right. You're yes, that was terrible.
Right.
I knew it. Yeah. How'd it go?
My first time. So I actually think I had some pretty decent material from years of writing and being an enormous stand-up.
From 9 to 10, 11, 12, 34. I don't have a calculator. But this is easily over a decade of dreams built up. People talk about Rolling Stones' first album, etc. This is your first, here it comes, the magic.
And the night before, I had a new joke idea, not knowing that a new joke idea is a real exciting thing and you should never you want to give that, you want to wait a little while for it to marinate probably if you're early on and go with your prepared stuff. And I was screw all this stuff I put years into. I have this great idea, but it was something to do with I remember the premise was I had looked up some... It was about web MD and it making you what's the word?
Idiot.
Yeah, an idiot.
Hypochondriac.
Hypochondriac. And it was, I didn't know everyone has a joke about this. And but it was about something about thinking there was something wrong with my butthole because my butthole was itchy or whatever. And I'm oh man, this itchy butthole joke's gonna. And it was something about I read some description of something and then that made me feel the thing.
Okay.
And so I had printed out here's the description that I'm going to read.
Right. Do you write then, on it? Because only you could see that. Do you also write on it? Pause for standing ovation.
So I didn't write anything else. Everything else I thought I had memorized. I get on stage, and I did, I think I had a couple opening jokes that I think went pretty well, because I told people, I was like, it's my first time. And so I think people were like really just overly supportive.
Do you ever think to keep doing that?
it's not a bad idea. And I do have a brand new show, and I'm going to tell people that.
Okay.
I remember the first minute or so going well, and then I was like, okay, WebMD joke. And I went to reach for my thing, and I had like grabbed the wrong paper or something like that, put the wrong thing
in my list of funny words. Shit.
Oh my God. It's like Gallagher bringing like, a melon on instead of a watermelon.
Tricks illusion. Tricks illusion. Why did I just write this over and over again? This isn't helpful right now.
Damn.
And I froze a little bit. Kind of like I heard a couple like ohs in the audience.
Oh, that's
that
the worst.
Didn't help. And I remember thinking of like kind of a couple of my actual jokes that I'd prepared before that and kind of like getting out of there alive. And then afterwards, I was like, I knew it didn't go well, but I was like, you know, can I do that again sometime? He's like, well, he's like, why don't you take a comedy class? Because it's, you know, there's paying customers and stuff. So it's not like a workshop. Right. I didn't really understand so how, like.
Okay, let me, Shane, here's the thing. So I saw it and you were there. So you saw it. Okay. So what we do is we perform for people. Okay. Now, a person is like, you're a person. Okay. And you don't want to be shat on, right? Okay. So this is 30 persons. Okay. So.
You pay for a product. You want that product. Right?
So how about we teach this to you and you don't waste people's time? What do we say?
and I took that advice and I took a class with a guy, Rich Gustus, who was this guy. He had been on like Dr. Katz or whatever.
How much was the class?
It was at like a tech school or something like that. It was cheap. It was like $180 or something like that.
You had construction money, right?
I'll spend $180 I don't have on a night out with my girlfriend over food I don't remember. Like this $180 was the best $180. As much as people shit on comedy classes and whatnot, I pay $180 to have someone be like, when you take the microphone out, you set the stand over there. That's worth $180. I promise you that's worth $180. And it was nice to, he was this nice guy who like actually had really good sensibilities. So I just had like other new people that I was able to run my jokes by. So I just had like a writer's group essentially put together with also other bunch of like nervous people. And I was definitely the funniest person in there. And like the teacher like really took a liking to me. And he ran his own open mic. And I went there and it was awful. It was an awful, awful, awful open mic.
What was this time around? What's your very first joke? Do you have
I do. I opened with, I masturbate so much that my bed sheets are like a starched mold of my naked erect body. Yeah.
Okay.
Seriously, I can bring a girl home and have a three-way.
I like this seriously.
Yeah. Sorry, bed sheets. I get the butt this time. Two tags? That's a pro. I mean, that's a pretty that's a well-structured joke for your very first joke on stage. Now, what's much funnier about that in hindsight is you have to understand there's like 8 Mile, like you only got one shot, like going through my head, like pumping myself up to like, here's what you're going to do for your life. This is okay. You've been putting this off for too long. You're in debt. You're like, you hit your, okay, you're going to do this. And then I get on stage, I masturbate someone.
And he's so proud.
Yeah.
So proud.
Spaghetti.
And it was really downhill from there. Like, that set did really well. But I remember...
It was when you were asking if people wanted autographs. Is that where it was?
It was... The open mic that I went to was a place called the Emerald Isle that no longer exists in Dorchester, Massachusetts. I once got mugged at gunpoint outside of it. It was an awful, awful part of town. It was real dangerous, real scary. The place was later condemned. There is only ever one working bathroom, and even that, it was like one of the doors was ripped off. It was like a movie. The air conditioning or heater never worked, so it was either too hot or too cold, depending on the season. And no, there was never any audience at all, but they gave a free slice to anyone that performed and of pizza to anyone that performed and stuck around until midnight drinking, hopefully.
Right.
So basically, they'd just make beer money off of these comics, but because they did that, homeless people would come in to do sets because they get a free slice of pizza. So there's often like homeless people performing and that's stuff. So
how'd they do?
All these, you know,
at your career?
Yeah, it was, you know, they're really, really better than some of the comics out there. Say, like,
they probably have great stories.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they're always reading the newspaper. And they're one of, and they can all, you know, how the best comedy is saying what I do. All they do is stare at me. They know what I do. Right?
And it's also like the comedy is about finding different perspectives. Mm-hmm. Who has a different, more different perspective?
My perspective is everybody's kneecaps, and here's the thoughts.
Here's the thing about
right. Did you know, guys, you can rent dogs? No, I didn't know that. This guy's funny.
You can rent.
But you think, at what point do you tell your parents, or you wait until it's TV time?
Yeah, like I waited until it was TV time. Fortunately, that happened fairly quick for me. But the first 2 months were crippling anxiety. Like, I went on stage with like a notepad instead and read off of a notepad. And I remember my stand-up teacher early on, at one point, you know, it was like four or five weeks in, and I was hoping things were going to progress faster. And I was like, I don't know. I just thought like I'd be more comfortable on stage. I would have less nerves by now. And he just goes, well, if I was going on stage to perform 5 minutes of masturbation material, I'd be nervous too.
And great advice.
And you go, oh, so I should be. Okay, good. So I should be. He goes, no, Tim Allen, that's not what I said. What I said was...
He did. He often gave me a lot of like aim high. He knew I was like good at... that I understood joke structures like really, really well. But it was all like... you know, my way of pushing boundaries was always just like kind of gross stuff. Gross but clever was a lot of my very, very early stuff. Yeah. Cleverly structured gross things, right. Like no one needs to hear about like whatever weird sex act with poop or something.
Like, is that the Mona Lisa, but you get closer and it's made out of penises? So I guess it is, you know.
And within two, so then there was a graduation show for the class back at the comedy studio where I had started. And so this was after 8 weeks of class. And so I had now performed like eight times as I was performing at this awful open mic each week. And I don't know if I went somewhere else or not. I don't think that I did, but I was doing a new 5 minutes each week. And so I would get like a chuckle each time. And so I strung together the things that got a chuckle on the graduation show. It was also like this, you know, supportive audience. So like, here's some newcomers. And there's like people like Joe List was there. He'd been at it for a few years, and I got on stage and like destroyed. I had like a fantastic like 5 to 7 minutes, did better than almost anyone, including like veterans on the show. And then like people like Joe List that were kind of established on the scene happened to be in the room at that time, and they're like, who is this guy? This guy's really funny. And then they got me all these spots around town. And
wow, I was that's
able
fast.
And so I was able to like do, there's the Comedy Connection at the time in Faneuil Hall was a club that existed that was kind of like a big deal. And I was getting spots there like immediately. And then
were you doing the same 5 to 7 in those spots?
No, I was doing new material quite a bit. I had notebooks upon notebooks upon notebooks to like go through to find some stuff. So,
do you still have those?
No, because I was in the middle of moving one time. I was so concerned about losing my notebooks or my notebooks being like my car getting broken into or something like that, that I took them into a club, the Emerald Isle, this real crappy place. And I got hammered and I left them all there and never saw them again. Wow. It was kind of a freeing. This is a couple of years in. So that was that. And then, yeah, my first time.
Do you think that was a little wake up thing where like this good that they're lost, that there has to be a new me? You know what I mean? Like I can be better than this. Did you feel that way at all?
Not really. I thought like maybe I should not drink so much.
Okay.
but yeah, that didn't. Alcohol was always a issue for me. But I didn't drink when I started. I drank after I was comfortable on stage. I started like getting a little loose with it.
And you're sober now for quite a while, a year?
Yeah, a little over a year.
Okay. Do you notice a difference that like I am a little more present? My jokes are a little sharper, or is it all the same?
Well, the first time I quit drinking for like 3 years, I just like fell apart. I didn't know. I had zero confidence. I didn't know what I was doing. I had to like relearn how to do stand up. And I was trying to change my entire act. I was going from like absurdist comedian to this guy that does like big themed shows with like sciencey material. And at first I was like really, really bad at it. And
yeah, I think it's okay to drink if you're performing. I quit drinking, but if I'm doing a Keith and the Girls show, then I'm allowed.
Oh, yeah, sure. Sure.
We just do 16 shows a day now.
Up a little bit.
Yeah. So when do you get the first TV job?
Yeah, I had I moved up really quickly because my first time. So I got hosting gigs really quickly, too, and I was so bad at hosting that. But people really liked me because I was like awkward. I was too awkward to be a host, but people liked my material. So they bumped me up to featuring right away.
What was tough about hosting? Because you have to engage more as opposed to just doing your
like,
act?
My stuff was like very, it was like very dark. I was like kind of like a filthy Stephen Wright or something like that when I first started. And that's not like the best, it's not the cheerleader that like, but the Boston scene at the time was very like old school stereotypical, like host is meant to be this sort of a way.
Right.
And so I got bumped up to feature like immediately. And so then I had all this experience and a little bit of buzz around town. And then I was in the Boston Comedy Festival in 2006 and I did really well and got in the finals in that. Took some awful advice and kind of didn't do that well in the finals. And
what was the awful advice?
Yeah, what could ruin it all?
There was some people that were like industry people that I now know are like, managers that are like you don't want as managers, and one of them was like working with the festival, and they were like, "We're gonna record the festival the finals. It's gonna be your bit might be on the album, and this album it's gonna be on like radio and everywhere, and so you should like if you're cleaner, then it'll be on this album that's going to be huge and that's going to be." And so I like did all of my clean material and like changed everything I would have normally done. And I like, well, I want to be on this comedy album. Like it was stupid.
Like they won't find a way to play you if it's so great.
Yeah.
No matter what.
And I am on that comedy album.
Right.
And it, once in a while it does get played on a thing. So they weren't lying.
Right.
But yeah, I came in like seventh out of eighth or something like that. Young man, Dan Bulger won the thing at the age of like 18 or something.
Right.
And then I got in this HBO US Comedy Arts Festival that was in 2007. It used to be a big deal. It no longer exists. But it was like the Montreal, it was the very, it was in America. It was like, if you're an up and coming comic, it was John Mulaney was there and like TJ Miller and Eric Andre and all of these huge, Eric Andre. The very first time I performed, because he started in Boston, the very, very first time I performed, he went on stage like a person or two before me and did like the most offensive stuff. Like, I thought it was funny, but it was like the most obnoxiously, he was very new as well. And I was like, oh, well, I feel a lot more comfortable about what I'm going to say now that he did all of the, like, whatever abortion jokes or whatever that a person can do. But yeah, this festival, this was like every, like now all these people that are like, you know, doing very, very well for themselves, were there. And I, destroyed at this festival and did really, really well. I ended up winning this award for best stand up and the Conan people had seen me there and asked me to be on Conan. Now I have like my pick of agents and managers my first time on Conan.
How far were you into your career your first time on Conan?
It was just before, it was like a week before entering my third year into comedy.
Wow, that's fast.
So my second year of doing comedy, I got on.
That's the secret, right? Because it takes people easily over a decade. Mm-hmm. But you say, no, do it faster.
Yeah, you should do it faster.
Just do it right away. What are you scared of? Right? Do a festival.
Yeah, I don't know why people are waiting so long.
Win it. Then take some offers. Now I need my 100,000 hours. You know, okay, but chances come and chances go. You get one shot, right?
You only got one shot. That's tell right. That masturbation joke. So I was, so at the time I was working a security job. So I had... I was in New York, and my agent was like, you got to call the Conan people. I think they want you on the show. And,
you got to call the Conan people.
But at this time it was like, things were happening so fast that it was like, well, do I want to do Conan or Letterman? I've got to, which one's going to be my debut? And I was like, at this point, I was like, well, I guess this is just my life now. It's just like I'm on this rocket ship to stardom,
right.
Not knowing that my career would plateau for many years soon after. But I would, so they were like, you call the Conan people, they want to talk to you. I call them and they're like, hey, we want you on the show. Can you email us like your material? Like one of them saw me and I was like, well, yeah, I can in a few days when I'm back home. And I like, oh, I don't have my computer with me. And they're like, well, can you get it? Can you like, I don't know,
dictate it to someone on the phone or something.
So yeah, they were eventually they're like, well, can you just tell us the material on the phone? And so I got off the Feng Hua bus and in Chinatown, New York, and I went into my 5-minute act as I'm like, okay, so that part people get awkward and then like there's a reversal and I'm like explaining to them how the audience would normally react at that time.
I shift my body weight around here. You'll see why that's important later.
When I take the mic out of the stand, I put it to the side. I learned that early on. That was worth $180.
And I got done with my little act on the phone. And as I was going to meet my like future manager, by the way, and I see him and they're like, okay, would you like to be on next Tuesday?
Whoa.
And I was like, okay, yeah, I would. And I'll see you next Tuesday. And I was like, hi, future manager. I just got Conan. And he's like, great. You want to be, you want to come out to LA and we can get you meetings and all these things? I'm like, I guess so. And I'm like, well, here we go. And all that I wanted was when I was a teenager, all that I wanted is so I got on Conan. I did my first set, went over very well. People were very excited about it.
And what about your family who just found out you did stand up?
Horrified.
Horrified.
My grandma had they found out I was doing stand up comedy on this Conan O'Brien show, and my grandma went and she printed out flyers to hand out to everyone at church. that her grandson was going to be on TV. She didn't know my first joke. So then I did like vagina jokes and stuff. And
what was your first joke? Do you remember on TV?
It's really hard to, it involves intentionally bombing and then recovering. It was,
act like we're on the phone.
Sure.
Describe the parentheses.
Yeah. So, I had a great idea the other day. It's for a bumper sticker. It just says on it, I am a child molester. People are like, what the fuck? Right. And I go, hold on. It's, you don't put it on your car. and then the last joke was my girlfriend's kind of a pessimist in the bedroom. The vagina is always half empty. Maybe that wasn't my last joke, but that's that was funny. One that my grandma really didn't care for. So the vagina material really, they didn't, my family was just.
Did they ever recover from your Conan?
Well, they switched churches.
Did they really?
Yeah. Yeah, they switched churches immediately. I think they went back recently, like 15 years. They're like, okay, I think we can show our face again after like 15 years. I was sitting on their small town Midwestern, pretty like conservative, judgmental.
This sounds like my parents. Anything that I got that was entertainment-like, they tried to cover it up, or they would be like, when are you going to be done with this? This is embarrassing. Mm-hmm. This is what whores do. Like, legitimately, this is what whores do. I'm like, no, whores suck dick. Like, this is a microphone.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were very against it.
Yeah. It's still been weird. I still have, like, aunts and uncles that have never come to a show of mine.
Well, I mean, you're saying that's Conan. There's Jimmy Kimmel. There's your own special in Comedy Central. There's Showtime.
Yeah, I got on.
They know you're not quitting.
Yeah. I had, my third year of doing stand-up, I had 8 television spots in my third year of being a stand-up comedian. All different material.
So much shame.
All of them. And so much shame to spread. And so, and then, one of it being Live at Gotham, and all that I wanted, like my biggest dream, like when I was a teenager, like planning these, was I wanted a Comedy Central Presents. I was like, oh, okay, I want a half hour Comedy Central special.
Because that's what you saw growing up, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like Zach Galifianakis and like Todd Barry and all these, like,
I'm thinking what my background's going to be on stage.
Right. How my name is going to be presented.
Yeah. And I got that. And, I just had this fantastic set. My Comedy Central Presents was really wonderful. And I remember afterwards.
Where's the retirement money?
Like, well, now what do I do? Yeah. Because there's definitely, it's not, you have it in your head that's just like, that's going to be it. And then there's still, you can have a Comedy Central Presents and still have a whole lot of the industry not care at all, because that is not enough to mean that you're going to get butts in a seat in a comedy club or anything else.
Well, you mentioned briefly you were doing security. Is this at the time with Conan?
Yeah. I was a temp laborer at these construction sites. Because I wanted a flexible job. I started to do road work, and I had at this one site, there were these security guys all the time, and they knew I was a comic, and so I was friendly with them, and they were never doing anything. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, how do I? Mm-hmm. I was like, I want to do your guys' job, and they're like, well, you can just like, we can give you a job. And I was like, really? And what the security was? So all that it was these are massive. So it was like, they'd buy this enormous property and build like 10 different apartment buildings on it, like a little like gated apartment community sort of situation with the pools and stuff. And so to offset like the cost of insurance, they would have to have a security company. But it wasn't for, they didn't actually want them doing any security. They just wanted the discount on the insurance. Oh. And so the job was sit in your car. It didn't give you a uniform or anything like that. Sit by the security booth. You can go into the booth if you want to, or sit outside. But like, just you be there so people can see that you're there, and don't do anything. Like, just they said, just please don't get caught sleeping. They didn't say don't sleep. They said don't get caught. I just kind of got to pick my own hours and everything else. I would often like go there for the late night, the third shift, and I would like drive and go and do sets, and then I'd go back and sleep in my car and wake up in the morning. And it was this fantastic job. I would still have it to this day if I probably if
Conan! I could do something
similar. But what happened was I so on this particular site that I was working security at more than the other sites, there was this old insane asylum or whatever, this old historic insane asylum. There's like some B horror movie made about it and blah, blah, blah. And so because it was like haunted, that was the rumor, all these teenagers would go to have drinking parties there, you know, before this construction process. And apparently that didn't stop necessarily during the construction process. So on the night that I was on Conan, some teenagers snuck into this construction site for some drinks, got a little loose, went into like one of these unfinished buildings, you know, it's like three stories or like 50 apartments or something like that. And thought it'd be fun to like, you know, just turn the gas on.
Oh my God.
And so they turned the gas on in this building and then the building eventually just exploded. And it...
With them in it or no?
Not with them in it, no. Not only did that building explode, like ceased to exist, but all of the windows in the two buildings adjacent to it also were knocked out. One of them was a little more finished, so it had siding on it. All the siding was melted out. This was an enormous explosion. And a police officer saw this explosion. It looks like just a bomb going off on a hill. Drives up there while calling the fire department and everything, and gets up to the security guard, and the security guard is sleeping in his car, which would have been me.
Right.
And then they, you know, there's a whole investigation and accountability, and it looked like the security company was kind of not the most, you know, up legit, to snuff, legit place anyway, and was no longer a company after that. And that's when I lost my job. And I was like, oh, this is as good a time as any to become a full-time comedian. So that's when I went full-time.
Do you remember that date?
No, I don't actually.
Well, the neighbors do.
It's a very local 9/11. Let me ask you.
It would have been
this.
Like March of 2007.
I don't want to get too heavy, but compared to what you know about construction and this explosion, could jet fuel melt steel beams? Just real quick, just give me a wink. Really? Okay.
Don't tell him if I'm winking or not.
Okay. Interesting. Deep down, we all knew, I guess. So do you go through a little depression after you get your big stand-up special? Like, now what do I do?
Yeah. I guess, you know, I'll do an hour. Because I had already been brought out to LA to take all of the meetings with all of like these studios, but it was, you know, it was kind of like embarrassing for my representation because I'd walk in there to like ABC or whatever, and they'd be like, great, so you're this new hot comic that's exploding everywhere. What do you got for us? And I was like,
It's your turn, yeah.
And I was like, I don't
even know why I'm here.
Yeah, I have no idea why I'm here. And they're like, well, what TV shows do you like? And I'm like, well, I don't really like TV that much.
Hello, ABC.
I guess I like documentaries. And they're like, okay, well, nice to meet you. You know, good luck to you. And then my... you know, agents would be like, here, we got you these auditions to go on this thing. I'm like, oh, I'm not, you know, I'm not an actor and these parts look stupid. Like, I'm not interested. Oh. And you know, all of these opportunities that anyone would kill for, or your average person would. And I just like completely blew them off. And so then I was like, well, you know, I just want to do stand up. And I wrote, you know, I was like, well, I'll get an hour special on Comedy Central. That will be my next thing. And I put that together. And then I remember looking at it. And I was like, okay, it's ready. And I remember looking at it and I was like, this is just not like, this isn't elevating. I haven't progressed as a comedian. This isn't, I'm not like saying, I, like, I'm not sure this is what I want to necessarily like put out there. And it's just like, I don't care. It just seems like the same. And I kind of like, and then I went through some relationship at the same time, relationship shit at the same time. And then I started bailing on that idea all while like, now I can sense that my agents and managers are like, well, you got to come up with this. If you don't like what's on TV, then you make something and make it your own. Like, you know, so I brainstormed some ideas. And in the midst of that, I was like, well, you know, I'm interested in science and I have all these sex jokes. Maybe I could do a thing about like the science of sex or something. And then I started like really looking into like every possible TED talk or any book that I could read about the science of sex that got me like really obsessed with evolutionary psychology and biology. And then I just became deeply interested in like life sciences as a whole. And that's kind of where my career split off into doing like these more themed things that I do.
Look at that. If you retired right now, would you be happy if you had enough money?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I'm really looking forward to the thing that I'm putting together now. And I'm kind of hoping it is like a retirement plan for me. I'm hoping that I put together, rather than a show that I have to turn over each year, it's a structured show that I'll do quarterly in cities. And I'm hoping to like build a thing that where I'm like producing a show and being on it.
With stand up and science.
Yeah. Yeah. Scientists and comedians at the same time. And or on the same show. So
where's the best place to find information about that?
Shane Moss, MAUSS.com. It's called Stand Up Science. And so I'm hoping, I don't know, I haven't tried it. The first eight are coming out soon, and that's the test run. If they do well, then that's what my future is going to look like. If they don't do well, then I have to reassess things.
Other than get big right away, what other advice do you wish you specifically knew, that you specifically, Shane Moss, knew when you were doing comedy early on?
There's some advice that I wish I wouldn't have taken. Like my representation made me get on social media. I had no interest in getting on social media, and they basically like made me. And I got like really obsessed with it for a while. And I was like, okay, well, if this is what I'm supposed to do, this is what they're telling me, okay, I'm gonna tweet like 10 jokes a day or whatever. Right. And then I put all of my effort into like Twitter for like zero payoff. And then it just like made me obsessive and angry. And then...
Yeah, they could take a part of your 20% and hire somebody to do that, right?
Right. Yeah. And then I would say that, you know, the thing that I've done the nicest job of is staying out of any comfort zone. And like, if I'm ever like, I take on new projects that make me uncomfortable all the time. Like, I'm very nervous about this new project that I'm doing. Right. And I intentionally do things that make me a little nervous all the time. People play it way too safe. And then I guess it would be that, yeah, what advice? I do wish that I had been a little more pragmatic about the business aspect of things. Like, even just like having an email list and, of people that I can reach out to when I'm now in Madison. If I would have now like 15 years of shows of, you know, 10 emails each show.
Right. Well, the beauty of the world now is you can do it yourself. The bad thing is you have to do it yourself.
Yeah, you pretty much have to these days. Comedy clubs have been my existence for a long time, and I'm looking to not be so at the mercy of the comedy club existence. It's all that I ever wanted in my life. Mm-hmm. It's all that I ever want. And, you know, I'd probably be happy with that. If I could look at 2019 and just be fully booked with a bunch of wonderful clubs that are like paying me enough to make a living and all that, I probably would be just happy to keep on cranking out.
So Shane saying, yeah, is he the best in the business? Of course. Is he still open to negotiations? Yes.
I think that's really good advice, because basically you're just saying get uncomfortable every once in a while so that you make sure that you're like choosing your direction instead of riding a wave that you've been riding. So every once in a while, kind of check where you are, see if that's where you wanted to go. and get uncomfortable for a little while.
And never think anything is going to be everything. Like, never think a presents, never think like a Netflix special, never think any of that stuff is going to be the windfall of happiness and success you need to be set for life, because the game changes very quickly.
It could
be a year from now, people are like, remember Netflix? Like, that could happen. It seems like so unlikely right now, and that could, some other different streaming thing could take over that's a little bit better, and you know, they have it figured out.
I say this to people all the time. I go, have goals, but kinda.
Yeah.
Shane, thank you, man.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure. Of course, you can hear more about Shane on Keith and the Girl. Follow Shane's podcast. Here We Are podcast, got a little science, but not in the boring way. I know what you're thinking. I don't blame you, but I dug it, and I hate science. Nothing worse than it. I'm trying to think of something before his podcast that I liked about science, and honest to God, not a fucking thing.
Oh, thanks. I'm trying to get science to people that fucking hate it. Yeah. I used to as well.
Yeah. They'd do one on geography. And one on plants.
I still am not great at geography. Not a big fan of it.
So if you're listening now, there's a little window here.
Right.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Yeah.
Right. Do one on plants. That's fun. You know, you ever walk around and be like, oh, good, another plant. You know, you know what I'm saying?
Hey, Keith, can you sing us like an outro real quick?
And now the closing theme song. What you just heard was my opening line. Please subscribe and tell your friends. Go to myopeningline.com.